So in July of 1925, over 800 cars pulled into this quiet memorial park in Washington state.
Right, just drove right in.
Yeah, and people pitched tents directly against their running boards. And, well, they basically turned a civic monument into a massive, unregulated squatters camp.
Which is just wild to think about today. It's the ultimate stress test for urban infrastructure, really.
Absolutely. And today we are taking a deep dive into how that exact same patch of dirt survived the Model T, weathered the Great Depression, and is currently navigating, a modern invasion of a completely different kind.
Because when you look at a piece of land that has been public for over a century, you are essentially looking at a geological core sample of a city's shifting priorities.
Yeah, that's exactly the mission of our deep dive today. We want to show you what a community values, what it discards, and what it actively fights to preserve.
And this specific core sample we are putting under the microscope for you is Cornwall Park.
Right, it's this 70-acre wooded oasis tucked away in North Bellingham, Washington, specifically in Whatcom County, right off Meridian Street.
We should mention where we're pulling our data from today because it's a really unique source.
We are using a highly localized, remarkably candid guide put together by a Bellingham real estate broker, Gennaro Schaffer of Bellwether Real Estate.
Yeah, and what makes this material so fascinating is the total absence of that typical marketing gloss.
Exactly. There's no hype. It strips away all the idealized tourism brochure fluff and just treats the park as a functional, mechanical piece of the neighborhood's daily life.
Which, I mean, that's the only accurate way to evaluate it, right? A
Sure.
park isn't a static painting you just look at from a distance.
No, not at all.
It's an active amenity. It alters traffic patterns, it influences local architecture, dictates municipal budgets, and dramatically shapes the daily habits of the people living around it.
So assessing it purely on aesthetics misses like 90% of its actual function.
Exactly. You have to look at the honest trade-offs.
And that functional perspective is what we're going to explore for you today. Because reading through the source material, I kept thinking that Cornwall Park operates a bit like a civic Swiss Army knife.
A Swiss Army knife. Yeah, I like that.
Right, because it's trying to do everything at once. It's an old growth forest, a highly competitive racket sports complex, a historic botanical site, and a high volume water park.
All crammed into a relatively confined 70 acres.
Yeah, but somehow it actually succeeds. But before we get into, the splashing toddlers or the noise of the modern sports courts, we have to examine the baseline.
We really do. You have to look at the literal foundation of this space to understand the physical constraints it operates under today.
And those constraints are entirely defined by decisions made way back in 1909.
Right, the original donation. The land was given to the city by Bruce Cornwall and Bertha James Cornwall Fisher.
And this was a 65-acre tract initially, right? Given in memory of their father, Pierre Barlow Cornwall.
Exactly. He lived from 1821 to 1904, and that timeline is just critical.
Because by establishing this as Cornwall Memorial Park in 1909, the city effectively froze the ecological development of that specific acreage.
While the rest of Bellingham just rapidly grew up around it.
Yeah, and that freeze is what gives the park its defining character today. I mean, if you visit a municipal park built in the last, say, 20 years, what are you usually looking at?
Well, generally, you're looking at terraformed land. The topsoil was probably stripped by bulldozers, the grade was totally flattened out.
Right, and the greenery is just like these thin little saplings tied to wooden stakes.
Exactly, struggling in compacted dirt. But when you step into Cornwall Park, you are instantly confronted with towering, mature, old-growth timber.
It's a completely different vibe. And the mechanical advantage of retaining an old-growth canopy in an urban environment, I mean, it cannot be overstated.
It fundamentally alters the microclimate. When you have a massive, unbroken canopy like that, the trees are engaging in a process called transpiration.
Which is basically the trees sweating, right?
Sort of, yeah. They draw groundwater up through their root systems and release it as vapor through their leaves.
So it's active moisture release.
Right. And combined with that dense shade preventing the soil from absorbing solar radiation, the ambient temperature beneath those trees could be 5 to 10 degrees cooler than the asphalt out on Meridian Street.
Wow, so it's like localized organic air conditioning.
It really is. But it's not just the temperature that shifts, it's the acoustic environment too.
Oh, because of the tree trunks.
Yeah, the sheer mass of those mature trunks, combined with the dense underbrush and the irregular surface of the bark, it acts as this highly effective acoustic baffle.
So sound waves from the heavy traffic, or the nearby hospital, they just hit that wall of complex organic material and scatter.
Exactly. Rather than bouncing clean off concrete and glass like they would in a downtown setting, it isolates the sensory environment.
But, you know, that isolated environment was severely tested early on, going back to that 1925 auto camping phenomenon I mentioned at the start.
So, right, the 806 cars?
Yeah, 806 cars in a single month in July of 1925. I was trying to map out the logistics of this in my head.
It must have been absolute chaos.
It really sounds like an early 20th century version of, like, a massive outdoor Airbnb or a festival ground, but without any of the supporting infrastructure.
Which is an infrastructural nightmare for a city to manage. But it makes sense when you look at the era.
How so?
Well, it was driven by this incredibly rapid shift in technology and middle-class economics. The 1920s saw the explosion of mass-produced automobiles.
Oh, right. The Model T and all that.
Exactly. For the first time, average families had the physical means to travel hundreds of miles independently. But the secondary industries just hadn't caught up.
You mean like the motels and standard RV parks?
Yeah, those hadn't been built yet. The technology of movement completely outpaced the infrastructure of accommodation.
So people just utilized whatever public land they could find. And a heavily forested park near the Canadian border was prime real estate.
Prime real estate that suffered massive ecological trauma as a result.
Yeah.
I mean, just think about the soil compaction alone.
Right, because the root systems of those mature trees need aerated soil to absorb oxygen and water.
Exactly. And when you roll thousands of heavy, narrow, early automobile tires over an unpaved forest floor,
plus thousands of people walking, pitching heavy canvas tents, building campfires,
you compress that soil into something resembling concrete. You literally suffocate the root systems.
Not to mention the sanitation liabilities.
Oh, yeah. And the localized air pollution from early combustion engines just idling under a closed canopy.
Which totally explains why the city finally shut it down. The records show the auto camp officially closed in 1927.
Barely 2 years later.
Yeah, the municipal experiment with unregulated vehicular camping died out pretty fast once the reality of maintaining the land forced their hand.
And it's interesting because that closure perfectly coincided with the onset of the Great Depression.
Which entirely reconfigured how public money was spent, right?
Yeah, and how public land was managed. Which brings us to the Works Progress Administration, or the WPA.
Right, the WPA era. This is the second foundational layer of Cornwall Park. Because when you walk through today, you see these incredibly robust hand-built stone walls and facilities.
And that stonework is crucial. It's not modern, fast-cured, poured concrete. The structural mechanics of WPA stonework provide this fascinating contrast to how we build today.
Because back in the 1930s, the primary goal wasn't necessarily to build infrastructure quickly, was it?
No, the goal of the federal government was to maximize human labor, to put people to work.
So you see the utilization of heavy local materials, like basalt or local granite.
Right, materials that had to be manually quarried, manually transported, and shaped by hand. It requires an entirely different skill set from the labor force.
Like actual masonry skills.
Exactly. Masonry skills that yield a gravity-retaining structure. Instead of relying on steel rebar tension hidden inside poured concrete, these stone structures rely on their immense physical mass to hold back the earth.
Wow. And because they were built by hand with slightly irregular local stone, they visually integrate into the landscape in a way that uniform concrete simply cannot do.
Yeah, that WPA stonework subconsciously signals to you, as a visitor, that this environment is permanent. It has historical weight.
It really gives the park this heavy, grounded feeling. So we have this baseline now. 1909 old-growth canopy protected by 1930s heavy masonry.
Which is a pretty incredible foundation.
It is. But let's look at how a modern visitor actually interacts with that physical geography today. So the entire 70 acres is essentially bisected by Squalicum Creek.
Right. The creek cuts right through it.
And weaving through the timber following the water is a network of over 1.5 miles of trails.
The trail network serves as the primary circulation system for the park. But what is really notable here is the specific engineering standard they applied to those trails.
You're talking about the paving, right? Because this detail really stood out to me in Gennaro's guide.
Yeah, the paving is a massive factor.
Because when you and I think about hiking in the Pacific Northwest, specifically up in Whatcom County, the cultural brand is ruggedness.
Oh, absolutely. You expect exposed roots, steep, muddy embankments.
Loose rock, significant elevation gains. That is the whole aesthetic of the Chuckanut Mountains just to the south of Bellingham.
But Cornwall Park completely rejects that model.
Totally. The trails here are wide, they are paved, and they are essentially flat. The highest elevation point in the entire 70 acres is only 78 feet above sea level.
And that decision to pave the primary loops, it's not just about convenience. It's an active policy choice regarding equity and access.
How so?
Well, think about it. A rugged, unpaved trail is inherently exclusionary. It acts as a physical barrier.
Oh, sure. If you're using a stroller or a wheelchair.
Exactly. If you are navigating a municipal space with a mobility device, or if you're an older resident dealing with joint instability, a heavily rooted dirt path is not an amenity for you. It's an obstacle.
So by paving the paths, the city fundamentally democratized the forest canopy. They removed the physical tax of entry.
Right. You don't need expensive hiking boots or peak physical fitness to experience the psychological benefits of an old-growth environment. You just need to be able to roll or walk on a flat surface.
That is a massive, underrated civic victory. And, you know, it probably helps with upkeep, too.
Oh, it dramatically reduces the long-term maintenance liability for the city.
Yeah.
Unpaved trails in a dense, rainy climate like Bellingham are highly susceptible to erosion.
Especially right near a waterway like Squalicum Creek.
Exactly. Constant foot traffic degrades the soil, exposing the tree roots we talked about earlier, which creates trip hazards and damages the 1909 timber.
So a properly graded paved surface manages the water runoff efficiently and protects the root systems. It's a win for public access and a win for ecological preservation.
It really is. But there is an interesting behavioral quirk engineered into this trail system that the source material points out.
Right. The Washington Trails Association notes this, too. They specifically mention that the trail junctions in Cornwall Park are mostly unsigned.
Yeah. There are almost no mile markers or directional arrows telling you how to get back to the parking lot.
And my initial reaction was, well, that sounds like a massive oversight, like a failure of basic municipal wayfinding.
It does sound like a mistake at first.
But exploring the actual scale of the park, I realized it functions as a psychological feature rather than a bug.
Because the psychology of wayfinding dictates how your brain engages with an environment. When an area is heavily signed, you are operating in a state of execution.
Right. Your cognitive load is dedicated to following instructions. Look for the red arrow, take the left fork.
You are treating the landscape as a transit corridor. You're just commuting through the trees.
But when you remove the signage in a controlled, bounded environment, and remember, at 70 acres surrounded by an urban grid, you really can't get genuinely lost in Cornwall Park. You force a shift in perception.
The user transitions from executing a route to actually exploring a space. You start paying attention to the seasonal indicators instead of staring at wooden signs.
And the seasonal rhythm here is intense because of the botanical diversity. The source material highlights this beautifully.
The seasonal changes are huge here.
In the spring, you have these massive established magnolias putting on this incredibly loud floral display against the dark conifers.
And then summer brings that deep, cooling canopy shade we discussed.
Fall introduces this complex network of mushrooms popping up all over the damp forest floor.
And because of the low elevation near the coast, the winters remain relatively mild and largely snow-free, which allows for year-round access.
So the lack of signage essentially turns a walk into a low-stakes exploration. It forces you to look at the magnolias and the mushrooms rather than looking past them for a directional post.
It forces a state of present-moment awareness, which is precisely the restorative psychological function a park is supposed to provide in an urban setting.
It's brilliant. Yeah. Now, if the trail network represents the wild, unguided aspect of the park's botany, the southern edge of the property represents the exact opposite.
A completely different environment.
Yes. You can be wandering along Squalicum Creek without a map, but the moment you approach the intersection of Illinois and Cornwall streets, the wildness abruptly stops.
You step into a pocket of intense, geometric, manicured control.
You step into the 1916 Rose Garden.
Cornwall Rose Garden, yeah. It officially makes it Bellingham's oldest.
And to put that into perspective for you, this plot of land was actively being cultivated before the United States even entered the First World War.
Which is astounding. The longevity of a municipal botanical asset like a rose garden is an incredible data point for analyzing local governance.
How so? I mean, isn't it just a matter of planting the bushes and leaving them alone to grow?
Oh, not with roses. Modern garden varieties and even the hardier species roses like the Rosa rugosa found at Cornwall are heavily resource intensive.
They need a lot of babying.
A lot. They are not native shrubs that thrive on neglect. They represent a high, ongoing municipal liability. They require precise seasonal pruning, intensive soil fertilization, persistent pest and fungal management.
And winterization protocols, right.
Exactly. They demand specialized, consistent labor. So for a city to keep this specific garden alive since 1916 means they've had to actively secure funding and labor for it every single year.
Every single year. Through the material shortages of World War I, the total economic decimation of the Great Depression, the municipal budget crises of the 1970s.
And the 2008 financial crash. When municipal tax revenues plummet, the first things cut are usually ornamental public works.
That makes sense. And there's actually a direct comparison in Bellingham, right?
Yes. Fairhaven, another historic neighborhood nearby, established a beautiful rose garden in 1917.
But they couldn't keep it up.
No. The city eventually balked at the maintenance costs, and that garden was entirely removed in 1998. The fact that Cornwall's garden survived is an active, century-long policy choice.
That context completely changes how you view a simple flower bed. It is not just horticulture, it is a monument to municipal stubbornness.
That's a great way to put it.
But the analysis from our real estate source provides a very necessary reality check for anyone planning to visit. The broker explicitly warns against expecting a sprawling botanical tourism destination.
Right. This is the no-hype part of the guide.
Exactly. If you are picturing the International Rose Test Garden in Portland, with its thousands of tiered bushes and grand walkways, you are going to be severely disappointed.
Because Cornwall is a neighborhood-scale planting. It's intimate.
And it is heavily supported by volunteer labor, specifically a dedicated park steward and local community members.
Which is arguably more valuable to the immediate neighborhood than a massive tourist attraction would be.
Why do you say that?
Well, a massive test garden brings tour buses, traffic congestion, transient crowds. An intimate, volunteer-maintained garden builds localized social capital.
Oh, I see.
When residents volunteer to preen the Rosa rugosa, they are taking physical ownership of public land. They're investing sweat equity into their own neighborhood.
And that sweat equity translates directly into real estate value. We will dig into the housing market deeper in a bit, but imagine touring a home with a joker and realizing you are a 3-minute walk from a garden that has been kept alive by your potential neighbors for over a century.
That signals an intense level of community stability. You are buying into a neighborhood that clearly values continuity.
And continuity is the ultimate luxury in a volatile housing market.
Absolutely.
Now, the Rose Garden is built for quiet contemplation. It is where you sit on a WPA stone bench in late June and smell the blooms. But if you walk just a few hundred yards north into the center of the park during that exact same month of June,
quiet contemplation is entirely impossible.
Entirely. The acoustic environment violently shifts. You hit the active recreation zone.
You hit the heartbeat of summer, the absolute epicenter of unapologetic chaos.
Yes, because from June 15th through September 15th, running daily from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., the park activates a massive free outdoor spray park.
And we really need to dive into the details of this because the transition from a traditional municipal wading pool to a modern spray park is one of the most significant advancements in urban park engineering.
The primary marketing point the city pushes for this facility is that it features zero standing water. And at first glance, that just sounds like a nice sanitation feature to me.
Right. It keeps the water clean.
But the source material points out that it fundamentally alters the psychology of the space for the parents using it.
It's huge. The spray park operates on a rapid drainage gradient. The concrete pad is imperceptibly pitched so that the water emitted from the jets hits the surface and flows instantly into graded catchment systems.
So it operates as a flow-through or a highly filtered closed-loop system.
Exactly. Meaning there is zero displacement depth. The water never, ever pools.
And because it never pools, the drowning hazard drops to near absolute zero, which is a massive stress relief for parents of toddlers.
Precisely. Think about being a parent supervising a 2-year-old at a traditional wading pool. Even if there's only 8 inches of standing water, your vigilance has to be absolute.
You are trapped in a state of high cognitive alert.
Because the risk of a catastrophic event is constantly present. But the rapid drainage engineering of a spray park removes that acute danger entirely.
So it changes the parental behavior from active, stressed guarding to relaxed observation.
The adults can actually sit back on the grass, converse with their neighbors, and utilize the park as a social space while the children engage with the water jets.
It transforms the facility from a high-stress hazard into a genuine, functioning community hub. And the city clearly understood this because they clustered an immense amount of infrastructure directly around this spray pad.
It acts as the anchor for an entire ecosystem of family logistics.
You have reservable picnic shelters, open fields, horseshoe pits, a basketball court, and crucially, two distinct playgrounds.
And that architectural decision to build two distinct playgrounds rather than one massive centralized play structure is a brilliant piece of spatial filtering.
Spatial filtering? I just assumed it was municipal redundancy. Like just buying two of everything to handle the sheer volume of kids on a Saturday?
No, it is a deliberate behavioral control mechanism. Think about the kinetic energy of children across different developmental stages.
Okay, like an 8-year-old versus a toddler.
Right. An 8-year-old moves with high velocity. They engage in complex, competitive physical play. A 2-year-old is focused on basic motor skills, moving slowly and unpredictably.
So when you force both of those demographics onto a single play structure, you inevitably create friction.
Massive friction. The older kids view the toddlers as obstacles, and the parents of the toddlers view the older kids as absolute threats to their child's safety.
It basically becomes a localized turf war.
Exactly. But by installing two separate playgrounds, usually scaled and graded for different age groups, the park naturally disperses the crowd. It filters the users by ability and interest.
So the older children naturally gravitate to the taller, more complex structures, while the toddlers remain isolated on the smaller, safer equipment.
It completely diffuses the tension and maximizes the capacity of the area.
It also creates what is essentially a free, full-day retention zone for a family.
What do you mean?
Well, look at the economics of modern parenting. Finding an activity that can occupy multiple children of varying ages for 4 solid hours without requiring an entrance fee, a monthly subscription, or a mandatory food purchase is almost impossible today.
That is very true.
But at Cornwall Park, a family can arrive at 11 a.m., claim a patch of grass near the spray pad, and cycle seamlessly between the water jets, Playground A, Playground B, and a picnic shelter, completely outside the commercial economy.
Which is exactly why this specific zone of the park operates at maximum capacity throughout the summer. And this brings us to the honest trade-offs you have to consider if you are looking to utilize this space, or especially if you want to live near it.
Yes, the reality check. Because Gennaro's guide is incredibly blunt about this. On a sunny weekend in July or August, the parking lot immediately adjacent to the spray park is going to be completely overwhelmed.
You are going to have vehicles circling, waiting for spots.
You are going to have families dragging heavy coolers across the grass, and you are going to be hit with a literal wall of noise. Shouting, splashing, the ambient roar of hundreds of people packed into a concentrated area.
So if you move to this neighborhood expecting a serene monastic retreat in your backyard, the summer months are going to be deeply frustrating for you.
And this raises a fascinating question. Does living a block away from a high-capacity, loud, parking-constrained summer attraction actively degrade the value of the residential property?
Well, the valuation of that noise is highly subjective, and it sits right at the core of urban real estate theory.
Let's pull on that thread, because if I am looking at a house priced in the upper $700,000, my immediate assumption is that I'm paying a premium for peace and quiet.
But it depends entirely on the demographic composition of the buyer pool. If the target demographic for the neighborhood consists of retirees or childless professionals seeking total isolation, then yes, the noise is classified as a nuisance and it suppresses value.
But that is not the demographic driving the market in the Cornwall neighborhood.
No, it's families and younger professionals. And for a buyer with young children or planning to have children, that noise is not a nuisance. It is an audible signal of a highly functioning, desirable amenity.
The packed parking lot proves that the infrastructure is successful.
Exactly. The shouting at the spray park translates to a guaranteed, safe, accessible social outlet for their family. They're not buying isolation. They are actively purchasing proximity to that exact civic energy.
So in that specific market context, the noise absolutely bolsters long-term property values. It's the sound of a community functioning properly.
The noise is a feature, not a bug, depending on who is writing the mortgage check.
That makes perfect sense. But there is a very specific type of noise echoing through Cornwall Park right now that is really testing the limits of that theory.
Ah, yes.
It is not the chaotic, happy shouting of toddlers in a spray park. It is a sharp, highly rhythmic, percussive popping sound that has completely rewired the park's modern identity.
You're talking about the acoustic footprint of the pickleball paddle.
The racket sports revolution has arrived at Cornwall Park, and it has brought a significant infrastructure budget with it. Our source material breaks down exactly how aggressive this expansion has been.
The numbers are staggering.
As of 2025, Cornwall Park boasts 9 dedicated pickleball courts. 9 courts in a single neighborhood park is a massive footprint.
To really understand the scale of that investment, you have to look at the timeline and the mechanics of the sport's growth in Bellingham.
Well, the timeline is incredibly rapid. The city initially introduced 6 courts in 2018, and the local parks director was quoted describing the public response as very, 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 very popular.
Four varies.
The courts were instantly saturated, demand completely outstripped supply from day one, so the city authorized a major upgrade.
Which finally broke ground when?
Construction was delayed by weather in late 2024, but it officially started on July 2, 2025. And they authorized a $198,000 capital expenditure for this project alone.
A nearly $200,000 allocation for a single sport in a multi-use park is a massive municipal endorsement. What did that funding actually build?
It funded a complete overhaul. They did structural repairs to the underlying surface, high visibility striping, entirely new net equipment. The most controversial part was the spatial compromise.
Because they couldn't just bulldoze more of the 1909 forest to build new courts, right?
Exactly. So they cannibalized existing infrastructure. They took one of the full-size existing tennis courts and completely resurfaced it, converting it into 3 new pickleball courts.
And that conversion of tennis courts into pickleball courts is basically the defining urban conflict of the 2020s park system.
They did attempt a compromise, though. They retained 1 full-size tennis court for the traditionalists, but they resurfaced it and added painted pickleball line markings over the tennis lines.
But there's a big mechanical difference we need to focus on here. The source emphasizes that Cornwall now has 9 dedicated pickleball courts.
Right. Why does the word dedicated matter so much to the players? I mean, why can't they just play on the shared tennis court with the painted lines?
Because the physics of the game demand a specific surface tension. When municipalities try to save money by just painting smaller lines onto an aging, porous tennis court, the playing experience is severely compromised.
Because of the ball.
Exactly. A tennis ball is pressurized and covered in felt. It is designed to grip and bounce on a softer, grittier surface. A pickleball is a hard, perforated plastic sphere.
Right, like a wiffle ball.
Yeah. It requires a denser, smoother, highly uniform acrylic surface to achieve a consistent, predictable bounce. So a dedicated court is literally engineered for the plastic ball.
Okay, that makes sense.
Furthermore, dedicated courts feature permanent tension nets at the exact regulation height, rather than requiring players to drag heavy, portable nets onto a shared court.
So by providing 9 dedicated, perfectly surfaced courts, the city elevated Cornwall from just a casual neighborhood hit-around spot into a highly competitive regional destination for the sport.
Which fundamentally changes the traffic patterns of the neighborhood.
Because now you aren't just getting the locals walking over for a game after dinner. You are drawing players from across the entire county who are willing to drive 20 minutes for a premium surface.
And that brings us back to the acoustic footprint you mentioned earlier, which our real estate source highlights as a critical consideration.
The broker's warning about the noise is very direct. Why is pickleball so much louder than tennis?
It comes down to materials engineering. A tennis racket utilizes synthetic gut or polyester strings woven into a tension bed. When a felt-covered tennis ball strikes that string bed, the strings deform, absorb a massive amount of the kinetic energy, and then release it.
So the resulting sound is like a low-frequency muffled thud.
Exactly. It doesn't travel very far. A modern pickleball paddle, however, is constructed from rigid composite materials, often carbon fiber or fiberglass.
Striking a hard plastic ball, so there is no deformation, there is no energy absorption.
None. It is a rigid surface striking a rigid object. The impact generates a sharp, high-frequency percussive thwack.
And high-frequency sound waves are far more piercing, right?
Oh, they easily penetrate the ambient background noise of a neighborhood. They cut through the sound of traffic. They easily penetrate standard residential double-pane windows.
Which is exactly why the real estate analysis is so blunt about this specific area of the park.
What's the specific advice for buyers?
The broker advises any potential buyer looking at a house backing up to these courts to literally go stand in the yard on a dry summer evening before making an offer.
That is incredibly practical advice.
Because you are going to hear that rhythmic popping sound continuously for hours on end, alongside a significant increase in parked cars from players outside the neighborhood, you have to actively factor the acoustic physics of a carbon fiber paddle into your mortgage calculus.
It requires extreme buyer awareness. you are trading absolute acoustic privacy for immediate access to a premium civic facility.
But if you want a competitive activity without the acoustic warfare, the park offers a brilliant counter-programming option hidden right in the trees.
The disc golf course.
Yes. While the pickleball courts are this dense, paved square of high-frequency noise, the park also hosts a completely free 9-hole disc golf course.
And the spatial utilization of a disc golf course in a mature park is fascinating because it doesn't require the pouring of new concrete or the clearing of land. It integrates directly into the existing topography.
Exactly. You just install the metal catchment baskets and let the landscape dictate the play. Those 1909 old growth trees we talked about earlier suddenly become your primary structural obstacle.
It requires no tee times, no massive equipment investment. Mm.
And because it is a shorter 9-hole layout rather than a grueling 18-hole professional course, it is highly accessible for beginners or families looking for a low-stakes hour of recreation.
But that integration into the landscape brings a significant behavioral challenge. The disc golf fairways are not fenced off like a tennis court.
No, they weave directly through the open fields, across the creek, and right alongside the paved walking paths. It is very much a mixed-use zone.
Which means the players are fundamentally sharing the airspace with people who have absolutely no involvement in the game.
Right. And the mechanics of a modern golf disc make this a critical safety issue. We are not talking about a lightweight, floating beach frisbee here.
Definitely not. A golf disc is a dense, beveled piece of heavy plastic engineered for aerodynamic velocity. It can travel at high speeds and cause serious injury.
So you can't just step up to the tee pad and blind throw your driver into the woods.
No, it requires a high degree of spatial awareness, patience, and civic etiquette. On a crowded summer weekend, a disc golfer might have to wait on the tee pad for 5 minutes while a family finishes a picnic on the fairway.
Or while an elderly resident walks their dog across the line of flight. It forces distinct, often disparate user groups to acknowledge each other and negotiate the shared public space politely.
It is an exercise in forced community interaction.
So, we have dissected the layers of the park itself.
Yeah.
We have the 1909 botanical canopy, the WPA masonry, the 1916 roses, the democratized paved trails, the engineered safety of the spray park, and the acoustic dominance of the $198,000 pickleball complex.
But to truly understand the value of this land, we have to pull the camera back a bit.
Yes, we have to look at the streets immediately bordering the park because the park does not exist in a vacuum.
The surrounding grid completely dictates the economic reality of the park.
Let's establish the geography for you. The Cornwall Park neighborhood is situated roughly 2 miles north of downtown Bellingham. It is bordered by other highly established, historically stable neighborhoods.
Like Sunnyland to the south, Columbia to the west, and Roosevelt.
But there is one specific, massive infrastructural anchor located right on the edge of the neighborhood that defines the daily rhythm of the area just as much as the park does.
Peace Health St. Joseph Medical Center.
Yes, the primary hospital for the entire region sits directly adjacent to this residential grid.
And when we look at the mechanics of urban planning, dropping a massive high-volume medical center into a neighborhood of historic homes alters the fundamental character of those streets.
How so? Like, what does that actually look like for the people living there?
Well, it creates a zone of intense, unavoidable economic and logistical density. From a purely logistical standpoint, a hospital is a relentless engine of traffic. It never closes.
Right. You have rolling shift changes for hundreds of employees occurring 24 hours a day.
You have continuous logistical deliveries, ambulance routing, and daily outpatient traffic. The baseline level of noise, light, and vehicular movement is permanently elevated, specifically along the Meridian Street arterial.
So you basically accept the ambulances and the traffic. But what is the upside for the residents? Why live there?
The upside is municipal priority and extreme market stability.
Explain the municipal priority first.
When you share a power grid and a primary arterial road with a major regional hospital, your neighborhood inherently becomes a priority zone for city services.
Oh, because the hospital can't go down.
Exactly. In the event of a severe winter storm, Meridian Street and the surrounding access grids will be the absolute first to be plowed and salted.
And what about power outages?
In a major grid failure, power restoration to the medical center and often the adjacent residential blocks tied to that substation is prioritized over purely residential suburbs. You are drafting off the hospital's necessity for uninterrupted infrastructure.
You are essentially piggybacking on their emergency status. That's a huge perk. And what about the market stability you mentioned?
A medical center provides a massive, built-in, captive demographic of highly motivated, well-compensated buyers. You have a constant influx of doctors, traveling nurses, specialized technicians, and administrative staff.
And healthcare work is physically and mentally exhausting.
So the premium placed on a short commute is incredibly high. If a nurse can buy a house where their commute to a 12-hour shift consists of a 4-minute drive or even a 10-minute walk through a paved old-growth park, they are going to aggressively bid on that property.
It effectively insulates the immediate blocks from broader macroeconomic downturns because the demand for healthcare and therefore the demand for housing near the hospital remains constant regardless of the stock market.
Precisely. It creates a localized hypermarket.
And the housing stock they are bidding on is fascinating. As Gennaro points out, this is not a sprawling development of identical new construction vinyl boxes.
No, it is categorized as established Bellingham.
You are looking at classic 1920s craftsman bungalows with deep porches, mid-century minimal traditional homes built in the post-war boom, sprawling 1960s ranches, and even a few larger Victorian-influenced properties.
The architectural variance tells you that the neighborhood evolved organically over decades, rather than being mass-produced by a single developer in a single year.
And that organic evolution is highly sought after by a specific demographic of buyer who values architectural character and mature streetscapes over, say, massive square footage or smart home technology.
But combining that historical charm with the hospital's captive audience and then anchoring the whole thing with a 70-acre multi-use park creates an intense financial reality.
When you look at the current market data provided by the broker, the numbers are stark. The median price for these homes, many of which are older and require ongoing maintenance, is hovering right in the high $700,000.
Specifically, $762,000 to $780,000.
And more importantly, the velocity of the market is staggering. Homes priced correctly in this specific pocket are routinely going pending in under a week.
A time on market metric of less than 7 days indicates a scenario where demand wildly, aggressively outpaces supply. It is an auction environment.
So I have to ask you to evaluate the psychology of that buyer. When someone enters a bidding war and writes an $800,000 check for a mid-century ranch house that might still have its original single-pane windows and a 1970s kitchen, what are they actually purchasing?
Because rationally, the physical structure of wood, copper, and drywall is not worth that premium.
Exactly. So what are they buying?
They're not purchasing the structure. They're purchasing the localized monopoly on a specific lifestyle. The physical house is almost entirely secondary. It is merely the physical ticket required to access the geography.
They are buying the geography.
They are buying the continuity. When a buyer writes that check, they are securing the guarantee that they can wake up on a Tuesday morning, walk a few hundred yards, and be fully immersed under a 1909 tree canopy that the city is legally obligated to protect.
They are purchasing the rapid drainage engineering of the spray park, so their children have a guaranteed zero-cost social hub every summer.
They are buying the acoustic baffle of the forest against the hospital traffic and the civic stability symbolized by a century-old rose garden.
You cannot rapidly manufacture that density of layered civic infrastructure. It requires 100 years of compound municipal interest. That is what commands an $800,000 premium.
It is the ultimate realization of the Swiss Army knife analogy we started with. The value isn't just that the park exists. It's that the park performs so many high-level functions simultaneously, accommodating an incredibly diverse spectrum of human needs within a rigid 70-acre boundary.
It really is a masterclass in layered urban utility. And if you are planning to utilize that utility, if you are visiting Bellingham or looking to relocate to this neighborhood, you have to approach the space strategically.
You definitely do.
If you require the restorative acoustic isolation of the old growth timber, you must engage with the park in the early mornings, specifically outside of the June to September window.
And if you are navigating the paved trails, you must keep your dog strictly leashed to respect the shared spatial dynamics with the disc golfers and the vulnerable botanical assets.
And if you are relying on the spray park to exhaust your toddlers in mid-July, you must mathematically factor in the parking lot constraints and arrive well before the midday temperature peak.
Because the park rewards users who understand its rhythms, and it punishes those who expect it to cater to a single static desire.
That is the reality of a shared civic space. As we wrap up this deep dive, I want you to consider a broader structural question about the future of spaces exactly like this one.
This is an important question.
We have dissected how Cornwall Park utilized a massive 1909 land donation to build a foundation of old-growth timber, and how it successfully bolted on the high-energy, high-density infrastructure of 2025, like the spray pads and the engineered pickleball surfaces.
But looking at the macro trends of urban planning, our cities are densifying rapidly.
Right. The acreage of undeveloped land within city limits is shrinking to zero, while the population pressure and the subsequent demand for both isolated nature and aggressive recreation are multiplying.
So the pressure on the existing 70 acres will only intensify.
Exactly. So the provocative thought you have to ask yourself is, how does a park like Cornwall navigate the next 100 years?
Will the quiet, unguided, unsigned dirt paths and the vulnerable riparian zones of Squalicum Creek eventually have to be sacrificed, paved over, and swallowed up by the relentless municipal need for more high-capacity sports courts and expanded asphalt parking lots?
Or will the sheer physical mass of those 1909 old-growth trunks and the immovable weight of the WPA stonework serve as a permanent physical fortress, defending the canopy against the inevitable creep of total urban overdevelopment?
It is essentially a question of whether history can successfully veto future development.
And it is a question every growing municipality will have to answer on a block-by-block basis. Thank you to our source, Gennaro Schaffer of Bellwether Real Estate, for providing the unvarnished mechanical truth behind the postcard imagery.
It's been a fascinating look at how a neighborhood actually works.
It really has. And thank you for taking this deep dive with us today. We will catch you on the next deep dive.